And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Thursday edition. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Today we begin with news about the Mod Weekend 2013. Its goal is to promote awareness and appreciation of South Florida architecture, particularly in Fort Lauderdale. Joining us now is the editor of Tropic Magazine, no relation to the past Miami Herald supplement, and he's John O'Connor. Welcome to you, John.
Thank you.
Also with us is author Hillary Lewis. She's an expert on architecture, history, and urban planning. Welcome to you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So I guess I could ask either of you this. What architectural style are you focusing on, and what years does it encompass?
Well, we're very much interested in the work of mid-century modern architecture. That's something that is especially prevalent in the Fort Lauderdale area, and it's been a type of architecture that's been somewhat underappreciated, but is important and is part of the history of American architecture and very much the history of South Florida. So we're extremely pleased to bring some folks to the area to see this.
So what era are we talking about, 50s, 60s?
1950s yeah. and 1960s especially.
Mm-hmm. And who are some of the architects?
Some of the architects that we look at in Fort Lauderdale particularly are Bill Bigney. Charles McCarahan was huge in Fort Lauderdale. Igor Polovetsky, who did Sea Tower in Fort Lauderdale and Sunrise Tower in Fort Lauderdale, also did the Shelburne in Miami Beach, so he's well known. Dan Duckham did a great number of buildings in South Florida, and Dan is actually coming back for this event at age 80 to visit with us and to speak at two of the buildings on the tour, so we're excited about that. And Tony Sherman as well. Tony did the Yankee Clipper and the Jolly Roger in Fort Lauderdale, and also was responsible for the Tropicana in Las Vegas, so he's another big name.
You said that this style took nature into account. How did it do that?
Well, various architects did it in different ways. Someone like Igor Polovetsky, in some of his buildings, like Sea Tower, for instance, which is on the tour, he made it's a residential building. The units are one room deep, so it's a flow-through building. This was prior to air conditioning. So you open the jalousie windows in the front. The building is shaped like a boomerang towards the ocean, and the breeze goes through the apartment and out the back window. So you get a natural breeze and natural cooling. So it's really working with nature. Also, on the buildings like that, they would place what they called eyebrows, big, heavy pieces of concrete that jutted out from the edge of the building to prevent the sun from hitting the inside of the building midday. So it kept it cool naturally. So it was things like that that they were...
Some of those ideas that the pioneers used.
Yes, exactly. And they came back and they used them well. And then in the 70s, they kind of got lost with the invention of air conditioning and central air. A lot of that was lost. And now it's starting to come back again as people are a little bit more energy conscious and environmentally conscious.
I guess many of these buildings have gone the way, though.
A lot of them have gone away. We've lost
from
a lot of
development and condos. And
yes, yeah. So, we love to preserve. We would love to see a lot of these things, the architecturally significant buildings preserved. And we understand that development is going to happen and things do leave. Sometimes I feel like a chapter historian, just take photographs and write about it. And that's the best we can do. But in a lot of cases, it's better for us to get the word out and let people understand what makes this so special in South Florida as it is in Palm Springs, California.
What distinguishes the features that makes a modern architectural building that warrants it to be saved versus not.
Do you want to speak to that?
Oh, goodness. It's always a tricky thing, and that's why you get into a lot of arguments, especially with developers who might want to remove a building because it would be less expensive to build something new. I think that it's hard necessarily to know precisely what makes a building great, but it's sort of like pornography. You know it when you see it. Mm-hmm. And I think that in Fort Lauderdale, we've been very, very lucky to have a lot of buildings that were left alone because a lot of development wasn't happening yet. In places like Miami, more things were lost early on because there was new development that was coming in. So I think we have to be very careful as we're now seeing a rise in economic activity that there's an appreciation of these buildings and there's a way to incorporate them into new development so that it makes sense financially to keep them and to appreciate them and to use that to really build a positive image for the locale.
So do you have a movement underway? Is there a movement underway to preserve the buildings? I mean, is that active?
It should be more active. We lose things just like Miami and Fort Lauderdale and Miami Beach are always under attack, it seems, especially in the, right now, single-family homes. Fort Lauderdale just lost a beautiful Robert Hansen home right on Las Olas that was torn down. And Miami Beach has just agreed to let 42 Star Island be demolished. And 42 Star Island was a 1925 Walter DeGarmo home. And so it's sad to lose those. And I understand people's property rights and what they would like to do with them. And I have to kind of let that go.
Right.
But I think it should be more on a city level. People should understand, here are the important buildings. Let's have a little red line so we know where they are. So when somebody comes and asks for a demo permit, maybe there's a little review there before they just say, go ahead.
I think their point was that they bought the home before it was designated historical, and it was done after they had closed on
it. Yes, yeah. I think a lot of times these homes are not designated at all in terms of historic value or architectural significance, and a little bit more of that has to happen in terms of at least letting people know when they're buying it, that they're not buying a teardown, they're buying a piece of history. The city of Coral Gables has done an excellent job in designation and in historical preservation. I think maybe people could look at what they've done as an example.
So preservation board should be get ahead on things.
Yes,
right.
Yeah. But in this days of cuts, I think in Fort Lauderdale they even lost their historical preservation person that was on the board with the city. They cut that job.
So. Sometimes what's really good, though, is to build an awareness in the local community so that instead of having to have regulations that prevent people from doing things that they think they want to do, instead you have them wanting to preserve those buildings, wanting to preserve those homes. And John mentioned Palm Springs, California. I was just there a couple weeks ago where they have a similar celebration as to what we're going to be doing in Fort Lauderdale, what they call Modernism Week. And it's clear that because the awareness in that community has grown so much and the appreciation has grown so much, you don't need to have the same level of regulation. Instead, people say, this is a great value. In fact, we'll pay more to have these buildings rather than have to have a board tell you, no, you can't do this, you can't change that.
Many people in this area haven't lived here a long time, and they really don't know the significance of some of the buildings. Mm-hmm. They may walk by it for a couple of years and didn't realize that that was built in 1918 or 1951.
They have to go on Paul George's historical tour.
Yes, yeah.
Or those house tours.
Yeah. I think that's true, and I think a lot of people look at these older buildings. Well, when we talk mid-century buildings from the 50s and 60s, may not really understand the value of the buildings, but as they learn about them, they kind of gain an understanding. And in Fort Lauderdale in particular, people now know those buildings. And when even if you look at the websites for realtors, they will tell you in no uncertain terms, this is a historical landmark or this is an architecturally significant building by Polovetsky or whoever it might be, which I find that's exciting to me because it adds value to those buildings as well. They come up in value.
It's part of our goal at the magazine to introduce people to these great works of architecture so that there's an appreciation and a better understanding of what's here, the value of these wonderful things that were in the community, and also to raise awareness of the extraordinary innovation that took place during the 1950s and 1960s here in South Florida. It's something that is not as well known, but so we take it upon ourselves to kind of to educate people on this so that there's so they join forces with us.
Tell us more about the magazine. You're John O'Connor. You are the editor-in-chief, and
I'm the senior editor.
You're the senior editor. Tell us about how that came, and I know you have a lot of architecture, but tell us more about it.
My history goes forever, but I've been in magazines since 1982. As soon as I left college, my first job was working for Andy Warhol at Interview Magazine, so that was kind of right into the fire.
How about some stories?
I've got lots. After that, I had told Andy I wanted to go back to graduate school for history of architecture. So the two people that gave me recommendations for school were Perry Ellis and Andy Warhol. So it was
not
pretty,
bad.
Yeah, not bad. So I went to Harvard for history of architecture. And when I came back to Florida afterwards, I decided to start Home Fort Lauderdale magazine in 2003. And Home Miami followed soon after in 2005. I ran both of those magazines with Hillary and other staff members that are still there, and Jim Baxter, who helped start those magazines. And we sold them in 2007 to Bonnier Publishing. I'm not sure what happened to the home title, but it's no longer with us. So people had been begging me for years to come back, and we decided Tropic would be good to start.
So tell us a little bit more about the magazine. We're going to take a short break, but just tell us what you feature.
What will people find?
Yeah.
Oh, well, people find not only information about the history of the area, but also what's happening now. Both John and I are trained both in architectural history and, in my case, very much in urban design and urban development. And so we look at the broader issues, not only at the aesthetics, but also the economic impact, what can be done in the future. We try to encourage folks to think out of the box and think about new ways. So we really want to see the city really improve itself, mm-hmm. and to have some, even if it's a minor role, in encouraging that to happen. So that's really where we're coming from.
We're speaking about, not yet, but we will be speaking about
Mod Weekend
2013 when we come back from a short break. We are speaking with John O'Connor. He is the editor-in-chief of Tropic Magazine, and Hillary Lewis is the senior editor. And we'll take that break. We'll be right back.
One, two, three.
Are you dancing, Bonnie?
Little.
Hillary?
I am definitely dancing.
Little taste of the early 60s. And we're talking about mid-century architecture. We're talking about Mod Weekend 2013. That's March 15 through 17. Tell us about the 60s theme costume party details and which character will you be going with? And you, Hillary? I've got some ideas what I'm going to go with.
Uh-huh. Oh, really?
Maynard G. Krebs?
That's
actually
a good one. That's good. I might be Thurston Howell the Third. So,
yeah.
It's costume optional party, but we basically decided that we would do this in North Beach Village, which is a rapidly growing area or gentrifying area of Fort Lauderdale Beach. And we are having this opening party at a new hotel, which is opening this week, called Tranquilo, which is created from two mid-century modern hotels that were completely revamped and gutted and redone, and they're beautiful, and we're ready to go with that.
Oh.
So the idea for that party was to really kind of start off the weekend with a bang and have a good time. We've got a DJ who's going to be there, Julian Marsh, playing, and drinks and hors d'oeuvres, and it should be a great time.
And so when is the 60s party?
The 60s party is on Friday evening from 7 to 9, I believe.
Okay.
Invitations, you have to go online to find all of this, but anyone can go to modweekend.com and find out all the information they need on any of the events.
All right, tell us about more of the events.
Oh, gosh, there's so much going on. We decided to do two tours. We're doing a double-decker bus tour, which will go to eight of the, we called it the Tropics, in memory of the 60s, Tropics Magical Mystery Tour. Randall Robinson.
Waiting to take us away.
Yes, exactly. Randall Robinson will be on that double-decker bus and teaching people about each of the buildings that they're going to see. And the buildings will cover everything from Maikai, which is a Charles McKeerhan building built in the 50s. Maikai Restaurant on Federal Highway is actually in Oakland Park, but considered part of Fort Lauderdale. And there will be an expert in that building to speak about that building. Excuse me. From there, we're going to Dan Duckham's own architectural studio, which Tropic Magazine has just overtaken as our offices, so we're very happy about that. But this studio was built in 1963 and overlooks Cherry Creek, and it was built, it looks almost like a miniature version of Falling Water by Frank Lloyd Wright. And Dan Duckham was very influenced by the Prairie Architects and Frank Lloyd Wright in general. So from there, we go to another Dan Duckham building, which is Schuster Design, which was originally built as the Robinson Beauty School in 1964. And that is a beauty of a building that has been completely restored by Louis Schuster recently.
Probably creating bouffant hairdos.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Beehives.
You got it. In tomato bisque colored seats. From there, we're going to a church called The Sanctuary on Federal Highway. That was built in 1950. 59, and we're the first group to actually go inside and see that building as a tour group, so we're excited about that.
But that's a functioning church?
It's a functioning church, yes. They're open to the public, but the minister there was very excited to get us to put them on the tour. From there, we're going to Sea Tower, which is Igor Polovetsky's signature building in Fort Lauderdale. He designed and built that building the same year they were doing the Havana Riviera in Havana, Cuba in 1957, and the building is absolutely beautifully restored. So it's an example of what you can do if you put your mind to it. After that, we'll go on to the Yankee Clipper Hotel, which was at Tony Sherman, and the hotel is shaped like a big ocean liner plowing into the sand. It's a great building, so that's a lot of fun. And then the last two buildings, we're going to go by Pier 66, which if anyone is not familiar with it, it's a high-rise building that looks like it's got a flying saucer on top, and that building is incredible. So we're going to see that. And then we end up at a new building, the Girls Club, which was designed in 2007 by Glavavik Studio. And Margie Nothard from Glavavik Studio is going to speak there about how architects and designers today use features from the mid-century in new buildings. And it's started.
What do you mean, the Girls Club?
The Girls Club is owned by, well, it was started by Francie Bishop Good and David Horvitz as a an art museum and center and a working studio, and said they just call it the Girls Club. I think Francie actually collects art by women artists mostly, and so that's why they called it that.
When you talked about one of the buildings that they had preserved mm-hmm. instead of knocked mm-hmm. down, mm-hmm. realistically, cost-wise,
well, go ahead. It's interesting because each one is different on its own, and we're entering this period where a lot of these buildings are starting to crumble. You know, it's 50 years, it's 60 years, and they're made of steel-reinforced concrete, and water gets into the concrete, and the steel-reinforcing rods spall, and things break, and they crack apart. A lot of people don't know how to restore this, and they're unsure of how to do it. The people at Sea Tower really looked into it carefully and how to recast these elements and rebuild that building so it's as good as new. And Hillary was just in Palm Beach a few weeks ago, and there's another hotel or condominium building in Palm Beach that did the same sort of work, hired a firm to come in and recreate those elements instead of taking them off and putting in aluminum railings or glass railings, which may be pretty, but if you take these elements off your building, you've really destroyed its architectural integrity.
Right. It can be much more expensive
it can
to
be.
Do
that's
that process,
what I'm wondering.
But it also can add certain value. And so that's what we've been, you know, we talk about so much in the magazine, that if you have that appreciation for these architectural elements, removing them would absolutely destroy the aesthetics of the building. So instead, you should be treating this in almost a curatorial fashion, but it can actually add value. And you can end up getting greater prices per square foot for
right.
your
so
condos.
In the long run,
it can be a very wise investment. But it takes a while for folks to come to that realization. Mm-hmm. But that's something that we look at very closely.
Hillary, of the genre mid-century modern in Fort Lauderdale, what do you think, in your opinion, is the most significant example?
Oh, goodness. I have to say I'm awfully fond of the Sea Tower that John just referenced. I think that's an exquisite building. There's something about modern architecture that's really curvaceous. It's something that goes against the way early modern was done. We think about them, the great figures of modern architecture who essentially were coming from Northern Europe, people like Mies van der Rohe, Walter Gropius, and you think of glass boxes. In the 1950s and 1960s, a lot of architects broke free of that restraint and were much more innovative. In the Northeast, you had people like, let's say, Eero Saarinen, who did the TWA terminal at JFK Airport.
And the arch.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. Yes. It's very, very interesting to see how this played out here in Florida. And we have wonderful examples in Miami and in Fort Lauderdale. But I have to say, Sea Tower, I think, is a very elegant building. I'd love to see a lot of new architecture that riffs off of that. And I think that that's starting to happen.
Does it share features with the Deco movement?
It does have some similarities with the Deco movement in the sense that it is decorative. There are aspects to it that are not purely functional which might go against the way some people are trained in architecture. But there was a sense of freedom and I think of playfulness and the understanding that you were designing for a resort environment and that it should be something happy and fun and that would relate to the seaside.
An example of that might be a building by Charles McCarran, a series of buildings called Coral Cove, which is a cooperative building, but it had Bermuda roofs as well as solid glass walls.
And where is that?
It's in Fort Lauderdale on the Intercoastal.
You know, I noticed in this Mod Weekend 2013, it says also Miami, but the tours and the parties and all that are just in Fort Lauderdale.
Everything's
is that right?
in Fort Lauderdale this year. This is the first year, so we're going to expand this thing, but we're really having fun, and we've had so many sold-out boats and buses. It's amazing.
And you want to talk about the boat?
The boat tour is sponsored by Glavovic Studios, another one of the architecture firms in Fort Lauderdale. And the tour is going to really give a true sense of what Fort Lauderdale is all about. I mean, when you think of Fort Lauderdale, a lot of people think of, oh, Broward Boulevard, bore. You know, this is not exciting. But when you're on the water, the city takes on an entirely different appearance, and it was built that way on purpose in the 20s when they dug out the canals and they built these little islands and made it. I mean, the first development in Fort Lauderdale was called, quote-unquote, Venice. So it was that's what they were going for. So those people will take people towards projects like Alagon by Klaus Moberg, which was built in 1957, a beautiful building with tray balconies that filigreed railings, just gorgeous, or Manhattan Tower, which was designed in the early 50s by General Motors. It was a General Motors building getaway for executives.
So once again, the website for people to get more information.
Website is modweekend.com.
And we've been speaking with John O'Connor, Hillary Lewis. And we've been talking about Mod Weekend 2013. It's been a great pleasure and very creative enterprise you have going for you.
Thank you.
And good luck
Thank
with
you.
The magazine.
Thank
it sounds
you.
Great.
Thanks so
Appreciate
much.
It. All Thanks right. for coming.
Food and Dining is next. And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Our Food and Dining Thursday is here. Chef, author, syndicated columnist Linda Gastenheimer is with us. Linda, I know one of your top passions is dessert, and especially
How
chocolate.
How did you know that?
It's only been 14 years. And we have an internationally renowned chef with us for tips and lots to sample, and we're going to have a real production going on, I can tell.
We sure are. Mm-hmm. We sure are. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi.
Nice to be with
Hi.
You, Joe. Chocolate. Need I say anything more? You know, diving into a piece of chocolate cake, and my favorite, licking the chocolate frosting, or biting into a rich chocolate brownie. It's a passion for many of us. And as one of my friends said, told me, it's not a coincidence that chocolate and gold are sold in bars. So Chef Alan Susser is our guest today. He'll give us his secrets for choosing, tasting, and cooking with chocolate. Welcome, Chef Alan.
A pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Oh, it's our pleasure to know. He's filled this studio. Wow. We'd also love to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any chocolate questions for Chef Alan? Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN.
Or email radio at WLRN.org.
And also with us, our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype. You can read Fred's wine column in today's Miami Herald. Fred, wine and chocolate?
Well, it's kind of surprising what you can drink with chocolate. In fact, you mentioned that chocolate is sold in bars. Well, beer is sold in bars, too.
So I was we'll talking see. About a different kind of bar.
Good one.
Okay, Chef Alan, just quickly for everyone who's now salivating thinking about chocolate, there's a special chocolate event this weekend. Just tell us what it is.
There is. It's an international chocolate festival down Pinecrest. It's the first one in Miami, first year for this event. And it's going to have chefs and chocolatiers and really a wonderful event outdoors. Lots of chocolate tasting, and mm-hmm. I'm sure a lot of fun and some learning as well. I'm going to be there teaching how to make chocolate and how to taste it.
Whoa, okay, that's this weekend, Pinecrest Gardens. Well, we've been telling everybody to fill the studio. So I've got this funny-looking thing in front of me. It's a log. It's kind of a 2-inch log, a thick log, and about, 6-7 inches long. And it smells, oh, my God, it smells so good.
And I see you've got a grater there, so that must be involved.
Yes. So what am I doing with this?
Okay, that you're going to grate. That actually is what we call chocolate tea from St. Lucia out in the West Indies. Well, the chocolate I brought today is from St. Lucia, Jade Mountain. We have an organic farm with about 400 trees, cacao trees it's called. And
wait, this log
sure
turns into this chocolate I'm drinking. This has nothing to do with tea. I mean, this is like, it's thick, it's unctuous, it's got chocolate, but there's a lot of other flavor in here. So now that everyone's got drooling over this thing, Alan, what's this all about?
Okay, so the chocolate tea actually has English background to it. And so that a lot of the Caribbean islands that had English ownership through the trade days of 200 years ago, this chocolate, they grow chocolate in St. Lucia. The chocolate is then rolled with spices. Okay, so it's
this
the chocolate bean
the
is that, that actually has the spices in it.
Mm-hmm.
So what it has is a little bit of nutmeg, star anise, a little bit of cayenne, cinnamon, bay leaves, depending on who and what, because this is made by home people, grandmothers, mothers, and very traditionally used for celebrations in the holidays. But a lot of kids grow up drinking it. It's a hot beverage, and what you do is you grate it into either water or milk. And boil it. So you're boiling just like steeping a tea. And there's no sugar in it in this log.
But this tastes very,
sugar.
Very sweet. Oh, okay.
Yeah, I add brown sugar to it.
Uh-huh.
And then it can be thickened with a little bit of flour, cornstarch, or just cooked down. So that's the traditional way it's made. So it's a thick, chocolatey, very aromatic. A little bit spicy because it's a little cayenne, the star anise, the bay leaves.
But I don't taste the hot spice.
No, I kept this kind of mild for you.
Oh, you knew me.
Yes.
Thank you.
But this is a traditional way of enjoying chocolate because chocolate melts at body temperature. So that at 92 degrees, it melts. And so that in the Caribbean and Africa, where all the chocolates are being grown, they can't produce chocolate. Chocolates are actually produced in non-growing areas in general.
But they grow the pods?
They grow the pods.
But that's it. That's all they do
They
there.
Grow the pods. Mm-hmm. They ferment them. Okay, so everywhere it's grown, it's fermented there, dried usually naturally by the sun, and then it's polished. And that's called a green bean, a green cacao bean or cocoa bean. That's
well,
sold
Chef
on.
Alan, could you do this with something serious like Scotch bonnet peppers? Or
oh,
like
yes, you could. You can. You could do that. I actually infuse some with whether it's chilies or like Scotch bonnets or curry or coriander. Just amazing things you could do with chocolate nowadays.
Yeah, then sneak it over on Linda.
It's a good thing you're on Skype, Fred. It would be dangerous here.
Yeah, but so that. The cocoa beans are generally sold like that. So from there, cocoa beans are sold around the world to the United States, to Europe. None of the European countries actually grow cocoa beans. None of them grow their chocolate.
Even Switzerland?
They do not grow there. They buy beans.
So we're always told, you know, Belgian, or as Bonnie said, Swiss chocolate is so wonderful. And so is it better than the chocolate we get here? That we make here
in
the States?
Well, you know, it's the producer. It's not the bean. The bean, there's several different varieties of beans, just like in grapes. We can refer to Fred on that. Just like grape varieties, there's bean varieties of cocoa beans.
Coffee.
Or coffee beans, exactly. And so that, actually, they grow very close to each other. The coffee beans and the cacao beans are very similar in processing. But they are sold off in Switzerland or Brussels or France or Germany, whoever's making it, they roast it, and it's the process of roasting and conking and grinding it together and adding their formulation of sugar or vanilla or any sort of additives that, that they add in, that's where it is. It actually is the Swiss, Mr. Lindt, is the gentleman who developed this process called conking, which is actually what brought it to the finer chocolates. In the early days, in the colonial days, chocolates was only for sipping. It was bitter and it was only for sipping, as in Mesoamerica. It was chocolate started off as a beverage. It was
the Aztecs.
Yes, exactly.
Had chocolate. It was like a spiritual drink for them.
But it was a beverage and it was mm-hmm. bitter, just like tea. Well, just like coffee.
Now, you keep mentioning St. Lucia and these trees there. Alan, are you making chocolate there? What's happening?
I am.
He has a huge smile on his face when I say that.
Jade Mountain is the place that I work with, and I do the food out in Jade Mountain. The hotel is beautiful. We have an organic garden, and on the garden, part of the garden's 30 acres, we have about 400 cacao trees. So I've set up a chocolate lab where I've learned to make chocolate. Before that, it's been about 2 years for me to learn how to make chocolate. I didn't know about chocolate. I ate chocolate. And even learning the difference between what chocolate is and candy, it's completely different. So that chocolate.
What do you mean by that?
Well, candy is something that you grow up as a kid, and you can eat a full bar of candy. And you don't think twice about opening a bar because you're supposed to eat the whole bar of candy.
Or melts in your mouth, not in your hand.
There you go. That's what you that's what you taught, and that's what you have in your head. And it's right. It does. But chocolate, fine chocolate, is completely different. And actually, that's something I'd like to take you through, is how to taste some fine chocolate.
Well, we've been waiting. Because in addition to this wonderful chocolate tea, we've got chocolate in front of us.
Okay. So before, what I'd like to do, you also have some beans in front of you. So before we do that.
I can't eat it yet.
No. I want you to wait. Take the bean that's in front of you. I have some roasted cacao bean. Okay. It's a cocoa bean.
It's roasted. It looks about the size of an almond.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And so that I just take it and crack it and just close it in your hand for a moment. Everyone do that. And then open your hand and get that smell. Mm. Okay.
Oh, but it's pure chocolate.
Yeah.
Smell. But there's nothing else in it. This is just the pure chocolate.
This is pure
chocolate.
No sugar,
nothing.
Nothing. So this is how it starts off. Then we make it into chocolate by adding generally very little. This, what you have in front of you, is a 70% bar of chocolate. 70% is a very simple thing. That means to a 10-pound batch, 7 pounds of it is cocoa or chocolate, and 3 pounds of it is sugar, 70%.
But there's little bumps on the back of it. What are those?
The ones that you have is chocolate nibs. So after it's set, we take some of the chocolate nibs. The nibs are the actual chocolate that you get out of the bean. That's called a nib.
And they're not processed at all.
No.
So they give this extra chocolate boost.
As well as a little bit of crunchiness, the flavor, and that real earthy chocolate goodness. Mm. Like, you know, it's like a roasted brownie.
Can I eat it now?
Eat it. Go ahead. Take a bite. And part of the tasting, just like with wine, besides looking at it, it's the first crack. Did you hear that crack? That's an important thing to tasting chocolate. That's a better bar of chocolate. It's processed properly.
If it has a crack?
Sound. So you listen for the sound. After the sound, if you stop chewing and just sort of let the flavors fill your mouth, let the flavors then go up your nose, sort of like breathing in over it.
I ate it already. I'm going to have another piece for this, you know.
Well, I've got more for you. Not a whole lot more, but I've got a couple more pieces. Now, if you think about it, first off, the flavor is all through your mouth. The flavor is in your nose. There's a lot of lingering flavor. I'm salivating from it, actually, talking
through
it. I think
our listeners are drooling from it.
But I never thought I'd have to be taught to eat chocolate.
Right.
But he's right.
But you can taste a little bit of tropicalness to it. You can taste a little bit of fruity flavors to it, and earthiness, and the bitter is nice. That's what I love about the 70%. It's just got a lot of wonderful flavor and texture, but also the way it finishes on your mouth, it sits there for, and so that you don't have to eat a lot of chocolate. It's very buttery, but that's actually the type of bean that I have in St. Lucia, which is a Criollo bean, which is a very full, fatty bean. which is beautiful to that style.
So are we going to be able to buy your chocolates here?
I may bring it in to sell it here in Miami in one boutique, but in general, you have to come out to St. Lucia to Jade Mountain and enjoy this spectacular place.
What about this? Thank you. I'll be there.
Although I may sell it in London and Paris and New York and Miami. I'm thinking five little boutiques for this special chocolate.
And the tea?
And the tea, absolutely. And we're going to package that really cool.
Oh, my goodness. That. Well, we're talking with Chef Alan Susser. If you can guess it, it's about chocolate. We'll take a short break here, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we've been talking with Chef Alan Susser. He's been giving us tips on how to taste. I didn't know I had to learn how to eat chocolate. and for all the you chocoholics, and I'm included here, we're all included, the Miami Fine Chocolate and Food Show is this Saturday and Sunday, March 9th and 10th. It's at Pinecrest Gardens. That's on South Red Road. That's 57th Avenue in Miami. Some of Miami's top chefs and chef instructors from my Miami Culinary Institute are going to be there. That's at Miami-Dade College. So there's going to be demonstrations and samples, and you can taste Alan Susser. Are we going to be able to taste your chocolate there?
I'm going to have the chocolate tea there, as well as I'm going to do some of the chocolates, and I'm going to...
That's worth the trip.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. The chocolate tea. You've got to come out for that. I'm going to do some of my chocolate as well, but spiced chocolate. The spices blend so well with chocolate. I'm going to do a curry chocolate with some pistachios and coconut and a couple other
Don't go any further.
A couple other ones. And I'll demonstrate also, so it'll be a lot of fun for the kids and the family.
Well, go to MiamiFineFoodShow.com for more information, or you can go to DinnerInMinutes.com, and that information will be on my blog. And it's Dinner in Minutes time. We have to have some dinner to go with all this chocolate, of course. But I picked a spicy one because we're having spices in the chocolate.
Nice.
So it's a cumin chili crusted snapper with tomato rice. And these are Latin spices that flavor this. So what I've done is I mix some flour and cumin and chili powder together. And I dip the fish fillets into that. First into just a little egg white. And then into the spiced flour. And I saute it for about 3 minutes per side. For a half inch thick, if it's a little thicker, then cook it a little longer. But just remember that when you're cooking fish, you take it off the heat. It'll continue to cook in its own heat. You don't want to overcook fish. The side dish, I like to cook rice like pasta. That's how we did it in France. So I add it to rapidly boiling water for about 7 or 8 minutes, and then I drain it. And I toss it with some tomatoes and some salt and pepper, a little olive oil. And that's the whole recipe. Mm. Simple and easy. You can read the whole recipe at dinnerinminutes.com. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. So, Bonnie and Joe, I know I can't compete with the chocolate, but how did you like the snapper?
Well, very good. It was a nice compliment to the chocolate.
And I tried your rice cooking method last week on some basmati rice.
How was it?
Came out perfect.
Well, Joe, I'm so proud of you.
It doesn't stick that way,
and you don't have to measure anything.
Yeah, right. I love that tip. That's a great tip.
So, is it one to two?
I gave Alan Susser a tip.
Yes.
Cool.
What's the proportion? Is it 2 to 1?
No proportions.
It doesn't matter.
It's just like rice. A big pot of water, boiling. Add the rice slowly so it'll continue to boil. 9 minutes, done.
Dump it in a colander.
Then you sauce it with whatever you want. Well, let's go to Fred Tasker because I'm sure he wants us to drink something with chocolate. Fred?
Absolutely. I did some research on what to drink with chocolate, and then I actually found some big surprises. It turns out that with chocolate you can drink wine, beer, coffee, and even tea. But you have to pick them carefully. The basis for flavor matching is that both chocolate and the beverages I named have many of the same flavors. You might have fruit flavors like cherries and blueberries, or bitter flavors like the tannin in chocolate, and also in wine, coffee, and tea, and of course the bitterness of hops in the beer. But just like what Chef Alan was teaching us about how to taste chocolate, tasting chocolate with beverages also has a very strict technique. What you do, you first swirl the beverage and sniff it, and then you take a small sip and you note its aromas and flavors, and then you swallow that. Then you place a small piece of the chocolate on your tongue, and you let it melt for a minute. And then you take another small sip of the beverage and swirl them around together to see if they blend or if they clash. And then you, I didn't know it was going to be this much work.
I was going to say, can we can we just eat the chocolate and drink?
Yeah. Well, it drives you to drink, I guess. Yeah. But then you swallow and you note the flavors that that linger on the finish. Now, people who have done this say that Hershey's milk chocolate goes best with things like light wheat beers or milder coffees and teas, and even sweeter white wines like Riesling or late harvest white dessert wines like Sauterne. And the semi-sweet, bittersweet, and dark chocolate go better with rich, hearty red wines like Zinfandel or Syrah, or what's my absolute favorite is rich, sweet, powerful red port. And some people will even match.
Alan's shaking his head up and down.
I'm right there with you with the port. You ready?
I'm glad to hear that.
Okay.
That's a good phrase. And so some people even match the darker chocolates with brandy like Armagnac or Cognac.
The very good Armagnac and Cognac, I would assume.
Oh, well, if you got good chocolate, you better get good Armagnac.
Okay.
Yeah. And, of course, the best thing is both chocolate and beer are chock full of antioxidants. So if you have them together, always in moderation, I suppose, you'll probably live forever.
Well, we'll live forever. We've been enjoying this chocolate here. Chef Alan Susser, give us some more advice about chocolate. The hardest thing, I think, for people to do is to melt chocolate so it doesn't get grainy. What should we do?
Okay, chocolate is funny because it reacts to water. So very often people say you put it into a double boiler so that you have the steam rising out of the lower container into an upper container, which is just melting the chocolate. If it goes slow, that's fine. Sometimes it boils up, and that's where you have that water mixture. Actually, the best way, which I would suggest, I think it's one of those secrets that lie in the kitchen, is using a microwave.
This is Chef Alan Susser telling you to use a microwave to melt chocolate. Go ahead, Alan.
But carefully.
I bet.
Using small amounts of chocolate. You can't put a lot in there. It has to be chopped up so that there's space in between. And doing it slowly. So that means putting it, depending on how efficient your microwave is, putting it in the microwave in a cup for about 10, 15 seconds. Take it out, stir it, put it back in, put it again for another 10, 15 seconds. And doing this 3-4 times. And that will probably melt the chocolate completely. You don't actually have to melt the chocolate till it's liquid. It should be like 3/4 liquid or softened. And then the last one is you should mix it on your own, just melting it to the heat.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's still heat within from the microwave, there's still heat within the content. So you have to slowly mix that around, and then you'll have a beautiful, creamy chocolate.
Right, because I don't think people realize that when you're melting chocolate and it sort of gets grainy or lumpy a little bit, the first thing you think you're going to do is put water in. But if that happens to you, put some oil in.
Oil or butter.
Or butter. Fat.
Or cream. Yeah, something fatty in
that fashion. Will help that.
Absolutely.
So another question I get asked so often, now that I have you here as an expert, what's the difference between semi-sweet chocolate and bittersweet? And can you use them interchangeably in recipes?
Okay. Chocolates are chocolates, and they can be used. There's difference in flavor. It's very much, as I started suggesting, about the sweetness level, bittersweet and extra bitter. It usually changes from about 70% sugar to chocolate to 60 to 56 and going down in that sort of fashion. So a bittersweet is probably about 60%, and a 70% is more bitter, more chocolatey. And then milk chocolate is actually about 36% chocolate.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And more filler, which could be cocoa, butter, and sugars as well.
So you have to be aware of that when you're doing a recipe.
Absolutely.
Add more sugar, take it out, or whatever. Well, this has been really, really a tasty week. We could go on and on with the chocolate.
Yes.
Chef Alan Susser, thank you so much for being here and for the fabulous chocolate. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Fred Tasker, wine columnist. Great advice as always, Fred.
Always a pleasure.
Bonnie and Joseph, you ate very well today.
Yes, thank you. And thank you for being here.
Pleasure.
Yes, it was so good.
Remember, it's the Miami Fine Food, Fine Chocolate and Food Show this weekend. at Pinecrest Gardens. Well, next week, we're going to be talking about kitchen gadgets.
All right.
Okay. And I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And that wraps up today's edition. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction from Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Follow us on the Topical Currents Facebook page. We also have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. Today's Dinner in Minutes at DinnerInMinutes.com. Tomorrow at 1, it's Ed Bell and the South Florida Arts Beat and another of his patented special live studio jazz concerts. We return Monday with Middle East journalist Leslie Hazelton, author of The First Muslim, The Story of Muhammad. He was born an orphan and became a prophet. Now today's calendar. On this day in 1921, 92 years ago, the birth of dancer and actress Sid Charisse in Amarillo, Texas. A childhood polio victim, she danced with Gene Kelly in 1951's Singin' in the Rain. And on this day in 1952, 61 years ago, actor Ronald Reagan, then Regan, marries actress Nancy Davis in North Hollywood. They appeared together in 1958's Hellcats of the Navy. One more while we head for the quiet comfort of the Bates Motel. On this day in 1960, 53 years ago, the release of Alfred Hitchcock's monochrome Psycho film. The blood in the ghastly shower murder scene was actually, fittingly today, chocolate sauce. There were some 90 splices in the scene. So we leave with a thought from Hitchcock, who saved money by using his TV show crew to film Psycho. Quote, "There is no terror in a bang, only in the anticipation of it." This is Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.